The Crusades Through Arab Eyes by Amin Maalouf, continued. Cassette 5, Side 1. As they passed Dorylaeum, where the historic defeat of Kilijahzlan had occurred, the latter's son, Mas'ud, was waiting for them, seeking revenge 50 years on. He laid a series of ambushes and dealt them some particularly deadly blows. It was constantly said that their forces were being pared down so that people began to breathe easier. But Ibn al-Qalanisi adds that, after all the losses they suffered, the Franj were still said to number about 100,000. Here, as elsewhere, the figures should not be taken too literally. Like all his contemporaries, the chronicler of Damascus was no slave to precision, and it would have been impossible for him to verify these estimates in any event. Nevertheless, one should pay tribute in passing to Ibn al-Qalanisi's scruples, for he adds an "it is said" whenever a figure seems suspect to him. Ibn al-Athir had no such scruples, but he did take care, when presenting his personal interpretation of some event, to conclude with the words "Allahu Azim," or "God alone knows." Whatever the exact numerical strength of the new Frankish invaders, there is no doubt that their forces, added to those of Jerusalem, Antioch, and Tripoli, were quite adequate to upset the Arab world, which observed their movements with growing dread. One question arose unflaggingly. Which city would they attack first? Logically, they should begin with Edessa. Was it not to avenge its fall that they had come? But they could as well assault Aleppo, striking at the head of the rising power of Nur al-Din. In that event, Edessa would fall almost automatically. In fact, neither was the target. After lengthy disputes among their kings, says Ibn al-Qalanisi, they finally agreed among themselves to attack Damascus, and they were so sure of taking it that they made agreements in advance about how the dependencies would be divided up. Attack Damascus, the city of Mu'in al-Din Khunar, the only Muslim leader to have signed a treaty of alliance with Jerusalem? The Franj could have done the Arab resistance no greater service. With hindsight, however, it appears that the powerful kings commanding these armies of Franj believed that only the conquest of a prestigious city like Damascus would justify their long journey to the east. The Arab chroniclers speak mainly of Conrad, king of the Germans, never making the slightest mention of the presence of Louis VII, king of France, a personality, it is true, of no great distinction. As soon as he was informed of the designs of the Franj, Ibn al-Qalanisi reports, the emir Mu'in al-Din began preparations to defeat their maleficence. He fortified all the points at which an attack might be feared, deployed soldiers along the routes, replenished the wells, and destroyed the water sources in the environs of the city. On the 24th of July, 1148, the Frankish troops arrived before Damascus, followed by long columns of camels laden with their baggage. The Damascenes poured from their city in their hundreds to confront the invaders. Among them was an aged theologian of Moroccan origin, Al-Findalawi. Upon seeing him walking ahead, Mu'in al-Din approached him, Ibn al-Athir reports, greeted him and said, "Venerable old man, your advanced age exempts you from fighting. It is we who will defend the Muslims." He asked him to turn back, but Al-Findalawi refused, saying, "I have sold myself and God has bought me." Thus did he refer to the words of the Almighty, "God has bought the persons and property of the faithful and will grant them paradise in return." Al-Findalawi marched forward and fought the Franj until he fell under their blows. Al-Findalawi's martyrdom was soon followed by that of another ascetic, a Palestinian refugee named Al-Halhuli. But despite these acts of heroism, the advance of the Franj could not be checked. They spread across the plain of Ghouta and pitched their tents, coming close to the city walls at several points. On the night of that very first day of battle, the Damascenes, fearing the worst, began erecting barricades in the streets. The next day, 25th of July, was a Sunday, Ibn al-Qanisi reports, and the inhabitants began making sorties at dawn. The battle ceased only at nightfall, by which time everyone was exhausted. Each side then returned to its own positions. The army of Damascus spent the night opposite the Franj, and the citizens stayed posted on the walls watching, for they could see the enemy close by. On Monday morning, the Damascenes took heart, for they saw waves of Turkish, Kurdish, and Arab cavalry arriving from the north. Khunnar had written to all the princes of the region appealing for reinforcements, and they were now beginning to reach the besieged city. It was reported that Nur al-Din would arrive the following day at the head of the army of Aleppo, and so would his brother Saif al-Din with that of Mosul. According to Ibn al-Athir, at their approach, Muhin al-Din sent one message to the foreign frange and another to the frange of Syria. He addressed the former in the simplest possible terms. "The king of the Orient is on his way. If you do not depart, I will hand the city over to him, and you will regret it." For the others, the Colons, he used a different language. "Are you now fool enough to aid these people against us? Have you failed to understand that if they take Damascus, they will seek to deprive you of your own cities? As for me, if I am unable to defend the city, I will deliver it to Saif al-Din, and you know very well that if he takes Damascus, you will no longer be able to hold your positions in Syria." Muhin al-Din Khunnar's maneuver met with immediate success. Having reached a secret agreement with the local frange, who now undertook to convince the king of the Germans to abandon Damascus before the arrival of the reinforcing armies, he sought to assure the success of his diplomatic intrigues by granting attractive bonuses. At the same time, he sent hundreds of snipers into the orchards ringing the city to ambush and harass the frange. By Monday night, the dissension aroused by the wily old Turk began to have its effect. The suddenly demoralized attackers had decided on a tactical retreat to regroup their forces, and they now found themselves harassed by the Damascenes on a completely exposed plain, with no water supply whatever. Within a few hours, their position had become so untenable that the kings no longer contemplated seizing the Syrian metropolis, but thought only of saving their troops and themselves from annihilation. By Tuesday morning, the Frankish armies were already falling back towards Jerusalem, pursued by Muhin al-Din's men. There was no doubt about it. The Frange were not what they used to be. Negligence and disunity among military commanders, it seemed, were no longer the unhappy prerogative of the Arabs. The Damascenes found this amazing. Was it possible that this powerful Frankish expedition, which for months had caused the entire Middle East to tremble, was disintegrating after only 4 days of battle? It was thought that they were preparing some trick, Ibn al-Qalanisi says. But no. The new Frankish invasion really was finished. The German frange, Ibn al-Athir says, returned to their country, which lies over yonder beyond Constantinople, and God rid the faithful of this calamity. Khunnar's surprising victory raised his prestige and tended to make people forget his past compromises with the invaders. But Muhin al-Din was in the last days of his career. He died a year after the battle. One day, when he had eaten lavishly, as was his habit, he was taken ill. It was learned that he had been struck with dysentery. That, Ibn al-Qalanisi notes, is a fearful disease from which few recover. With Khunnar's death, power passed to the nominal sovereign of the city, Khabak, a descendant of Tughiqtan, a young man of 16 of scant intelligence who would never stand on his own 2 feet. The real winner of the Battle of Damascus was undoubtedly Nur al-Din. In June 1149, he succeeded in crushing the army of Raimond, Prince of Antioch, whom Shirku, the uncle of Saladin, killed with his own hands. Shirku cut off his head and brought it to his master, who, in accordance with custom, sent it on to the Caliph of Baghdad in a silver box. Having thus removed any Frankish threat to northern Syria, the son of Zangi was free to devote all his efforts to the realization of his father's old dream, the conquest of Damascus. Back in 1140, the city had preferred to strike an alliance with the Frange rather than submit to the brutal yoke of Zangi. But things had changed. Muhin al-Din was dead, and the behavior of the Occidentals had shaken even their most fervent partisans. Above all, Nur al-Din's reputation was nothing like his father's. His aim was to seduce the proud city of the Umayyads, not to violate it. When he and his troops reached the orchards ringing the city, Nur al-Din proved more concerned to win the sympathy of the population than to prepare an assault. Nur al-Din, Ibn al-Qalanisi reports, acted benevolently towards the peasants and did not impose his presence upon them. Throughout Damascus and in its dependencies, the people prayed to God on his behalf. when shortly after his arrival abundant rains fell, ending a long drought, the populace credited Nur al-Din with ending their sufferings. It was thanks to him, they said, and to his justice and exemplary conduct. Although the nature of his ambitions was clear enough, the master of Aleppo refused to comport himself as a conqueror. "I have not pitched camp here in order to make war against you or to lay siege," he wrote to the leaders of Damascus. "Only the many complaints of the Muslims have induced me to act in this way, for the peasants have been despoiled of their goods and separated from their children by the Frange, and they have no one to defend them. Since God has bestowed upon me the power to grant succor to the Muslims and to wage war on the infidels, and since I command great quantities of resources and of men, it would be impermissible for me to neglect the Muslims and fail to take up their defense, especially since I well know that you are unable to protect your provinces and am aware of your degradation, which led you to seek the aid of the Frange and to deliver the goods of your poorest subjects to them, subjects whom you have criminally wronged. This pleases neither God nor any Muslim." This letter revealed the full subtlety of the strategy of the new ruler of Aleppo, who now put himself forward as the defender of the Damascenes, in particular of the disinherited among them, visibly seeking to arouse them against their rulers. The sharp response of the latter only helped to bring the citizenry ever closer to the son of Zangi. "All that stands between us now is the sword," they said. "The Frange will come to help us defend ourselves." Despite the sympathy it gained among the population, Nur al-Din preferred not to confront the reunited forces of Jerusalem and Damascus, and so agreed to withdraw to the north. But not without having made some gains. His name would now be mentioned in the Friday sermons, just after those of the Caliph and Sultan, and coins were struck in his name, a common manifestation of allegiance by Muslim cities seeking to appease conquerors. Nur al-Din was encouraged by this partial success. A year later, he returned to the Damascus area with his troops, sending a new letter to Abak and the other leaders of the city. "I desire no more than the well-being of the Muslims, jihad against the infidels, and the release of the prisoners they are holding. If you come over to my side with the army of Damascus, if we help each other to wage the jihad, my wish will be fulfilled." Habak's only response was to call upon the Frange once again, now marching under the banner of their young King Baldwin III, son of Fulk. They soon arrived and camped at the gates of Damascus for several weeks. Their knights were even granted permission to wander through the souks at will, which inevitably aroused tension with the people of the city, who had still not forgotten those who had fallen 3 years before. Nur al-Din prudently continued to avoid any confrontation with the coalition partners. He withdrew his troops from the environs of Damascus, waiting for the Frange to return to Jerusalem. For him, the battle was primarily political. Playing the bitterness of the citizens for all it was worth, he sent letter after letter to the Damascene notables and religious leaders, denouncing Habak's treason. He also made contact with many military officers, exasperated by Habak's open collaboration with the Frange. For the son of Zangi, it was important no longer merely to stimulate protests that would embarrass Habak, but to organize a network of accomplices within the coveted city who could induce Damascus to capitulate. The father of Saladin was entrusted with this delicate mission. By 1153, after some skillful organization, Ayyub had indeed succeeded in winning the benevolent neutrality of the urban militia, whose commander was a younger brother of Ibn al-Qalanisi. Several personalities of the army adopted a similar attitude, so that Habak's isolation grew day by day. In the end, he was left with no more than a small group of emirs who still urged him to hold out. Having decided to get rid of these last hardliners, Nur al-Din arranged for false information to be sent to the ruler of Damascus to the effect that a plot was being hatched within his own entourage. Without bothering to find out whether or not the information was well-founded, Habak quickly executed or imprisoned several of his collaborators. His isolation was now complete. One last operation remained. Nur al-Din suddenly began intercepting all convoys of food heading for Damascus. Within 2 days, the price of a sack of grain had risen from half a dinar to 25 dinars, and the populace began to fear starvation. It remained only for the agents of the ruler of Aleppo to convince public opinion that there would have been no shortage had Habak not chosen to ally with the Frange against his co-religionists of Aleppo. On the 18th of April, 1154, Nur al-Din returned to the gates of Damascus with his troops. Once again, Habak sent an urgent message to Baldwin, but this time the king of Jerusalem did not have time to react. On the 25th of April, the final assault was launched on the eastern side of the city. There was no one defending the walls, the chronicler of Damascus reports, neither soldier nor citizen, except for a handful of Turks in charge of guarding a tower. One of Nur al-Din's soldiers rushed towards a rampart, at the summit of which stood a Jewish woman, who threw him a rope. With it, he scaled the wall, reaching the top of the rampart without anyone's noticing. He was followed by many of his comrades, who unfurled a banner, planted it atop the wall, and began to shout, "Ya Mansur! O victorious one!" The Damascene troops and the population abandoned any resistance because of their sympathy for Nur al-Din, for his justice and good reputation. A sapper ran to Bab al-Shark, the east gate of the city, and shattered the closing apparatus with his pick. Soldiers rushed through it and fanned out through the main arteries of the city without encountering any opposition. Bab Tuma, Thomas Gate, was also thrown open to the troops. Finally, King Nur al-Din made his entrance, accompanied by his entourage, to the great joy of the inhabitants and soldiers, all of whom were obsessed by their fear of famine and their terror at being besieged by the Frange infidels. Generous in his victory, Nur al-Din granted Habak and his close collaborators fiefdoms in the region of Homs and allowed them to flee with all their property. Nur al-Din had conquered Damascus by persuasion more than by force, with little fighting and no bloodbath. The city, which for a quarter of a century had fiercely resisted all those who sought to subjugate it, be they assassins, Frange, or supporters of Zangi, had allowed itself to be seduced by the sweet insistence of a prince who promised to guarantee its security and to respect its independence. Damascus was not to regret its decision, and thanks to Nur al-Din and his successors, the city enjoyed one of the most glorious periods of its history. The day after his victory, Nur al-Din assembled the ulama, qadis, and merchants, and delivered a reassuring speech. He also brought along large stocks of food and abolished a number of taxes affecting the fruit trade, the vegetable souk, and the distribution of water. An appropriate decree was drafted and announced from the pulpit the following Friday after the prayer. The 80-year-old Ibn al-Kalanisi was still on the scene to share in the joy of his fellow citizens. "The population applauded," he reports. "The citizens, the peasants, the women, the poor, everyone addressed public prayers to God that Nur al-Din be granted long life and that his banners be ever victorious." For the first time since the beginning of the Frankish Wars, the two great Syrian metropolises, Aleppo and Damascus, were united in a single state, under the authority of a 37-year-old prince who was determined to prosecute the struggle against the occupier. In fact, all of Muslim Syria was now unified, except for the small emirate of Shaizar, where the Munkitite dynasty still managed to preserve its autonomy. But not for long, for the history of this tiny state was to be shaken in the sharpest and most unexpected manner imaginable. In August 1157, as rumors were circulating in Damascus that Nur al-Din was preparing an early campaign against Jerusalem, an earthquake of unusual violence devastated all of Syria, sowing death among Arab and Frange alike. Several towers of the Aleppo city walls collapsed, and the terrified population dispersed into the surrounding countryside. In Harran, the earth split so deeply that the remains of an ancient city were visible through the immense breach. In Tripoli, Beirut, Tyre, Homs, and Mahara, there were countless dead. Innumerable buildings were destroyed. But two cities were hit harder than any others by the cataclysm, Hama and Shaizar. It is said that a teacher in Hama, who had left his classroom to satisfy a pressing call of nature in a nearby vacant field, found his school demolished and all his pupils dead upon his return. Dumbfounded, he sat bleakly upon the ruins, wondering how he would break the news to the parents, but none of them survived to claim their children. On that same day in Shaizar, the sovereign of the city, the Emir Muhammad ibn Sultan, a cousin of Usama, was organizing a reception in the citadel to celebrate his son's circumcision. All the city's dignitaries were there, along with members of the ruling family, when the earth suddenly began to tremble. The walls collapsed, decimating the entire assembly. The emirate of the Munkid Heights simply ceased to exist. Usama, who was then in Damascus, was one of the few members of his family to survive. Deeply moved, he wrote, "Death did not advance step by step to destroy the people of my race, to annihilate them separately, or to strike them down two by two. They all died in the twinkling of an eye, and their palaces became their tombs." Then he added bitterly, "The earthquakes struck this indifferent country only to rouse it from its torpor." The tragedy of the Munkid Heights did indeed inspire their contemporaries to much reflection about the futility of all things human. More prosaically, the cataclysm offered people the opportunity to conquer or pillage with impunity in desolated cities or fortresses whose walls had crumbled. Shizar, in particular, was immediately attacked by both the assassins and the Frange before finally being taken by the army of Aleppo. In October 1157, Nur al-Din was taken ill as he was traveling from city to city, supervising the repair of the walls. The prognosis of the Damascene physician Ibn al-Waqar, who always traveled with him, was pessimistic. The prince hung between life and death for a year and a half, during which time the Frange occupied several fortresses and carried out a number of raids in the environs of Damascus. But Nur al-Din took advantage of this period of enforced inactivity to ponder his destiny. During the first part of his reign, he had unified Muslim Syria under his aegis and had put an end to the internecine struggles that had weakened it. Now he would have to wage the jihad to reconquer the great cities occupied by the Frange. Some of his closest collaborators, especially the Aleppans, suggested that he start with Antioch, but to their great surprise, Nur al-Din opposed this. Historically, he explained, that city belonged to the Rum. Any attempt to seize it would tempt the Byzantines to interfere directly in Syrian affairs, and that would force the Muslim armies to fight on two fronts. No, he insisted, the Rum must not be provoked. Instead, they would try to recover an important coastal city, or even, God willing, Jerusalem. Unfortunately for Nur al-Din, events were soon to prove his fears justified. In 1159, as he was barely beginning to recover his health, he learned that a powerful Byzantine army, commanded by the Emperor Manuel, son and successor of John Comnenus, had been assembled in northern Syria. Nur al-Din quickly dispatched ambassadors to the emperor to extend him a courteous welcome. When he received them, the Basileus, a wise man of majestic bearing and with a genuine interest in medicine, proclaimed his intention to maintain the most cordial possible relations with their master. If he had come to Syria, he assured them, it was only to teach the rulers of Antioch a lesson. It will be remembered that 22 years before, Manuel's father had also come to Syria, supposedly for the same purpose. But that had not prevented him from making an alliance with the Occidentals against the Muslims. Nevertheless, Nur al-Din's ambassadors did not doubt the word of the Basileus. They knew the rage felt by the Rum at the mere mention of the name of Reynald of Châtillon, the knight who had presided over Antioch since 1153, a brutal, arrogant, cynical, and contemptible man who would come to symbolize for the Arabs everything evil about the Frange, and whom Saladin would swear to kill with his own hands. Prince Reynald, whom the chroniclers called Brinz Arnat, arrived in the Middle East in 1147, dominated by the already anachronistic mentality of the first invaders. He thirsted for gold, blood, and conquest. Shortly after the death of Raymond of Antioch, he managed to seduce and then marry Raymond's widow, thus becoming the lord of the city. His exactions had soon made him odious not only to his Aleppan neighbors, but also to the Rum and to his own subjects. In 1156, on the pretext that Manuel had refused to pay him a promised sum, he decided to take revenge by organizing a punitive raid on the Byzantine island of Cyprus, and he asked the Patriarch of Antioch to finance the expedition. When the prelate expressed reluctance, he was thrown into prison and tortured. His wounds were then coated with honey, and he was chained and left exposed to the sun for an entire day, his body ravaged by thousands of insects. The Patriarch, not surprisingly, finally opened his treasury, and the prince, after assembling a flotilla, disembarked on the coast of the Mediterranean island, crushed the small Byzantine garrison with no trouble, and unleashed his men on the island. Cyprus never fully recovered from what was done to it in that spring of 1156. All the island's cultivated fields were systematically ravaged from north to south. All the livestock was slaughtered. The palace, churches, and convents were pillaged, and everything that was not carried off was demolished or burned. Women were raped, old men and children slaughtered, rich men were taken as hostages, poor ones beheaded. Before setting off loaded with booty, Reynald ordered all the Greek priests and monks assembled. He then had their noses cut off before sending them, thus mutilated, to Constantinople. Manuel would have to respond, but as the scion of the emperors of Rome, he could not do so in some merely typical manner. He had to re-establish his prestige by publicly humiliating the brigand knight of Antioch. As soon as Reynald heard that the imperial army was on its way to Syria, he realized that any resistance would be futile and decided to beg forgiveness. As amply gifted with servility as he was with arrogance, he presented himself in Manuel's camp barefoot, dressed as a beggar, and threw himself before the imperial throne. Nur al-Din's ambassadors were present at the scene. They watched Brins al-Nat lie in the dust at the feet of the Basileus, who, apparently not even deigning to take note of his presence, calmly continued his conversation with his guests, waiting several minutes before finally casting a glance at his adversary and instructing him with a condescending gesture to rise. Reynald obtained his pardon and was therefore able to preserve his principality, but his prestige in northern Syria was tarnished forever. In fact, the following year he was captured by Aleppan soldiers during one of his plundering excursions north of the city, and he spent 16 years in captivity, before reappearing on the scene once again to play the most execrable of roles. As for Manuel, his authority was to rise steadily after this expedition. He succeeded in imposing his suzerainty over the Frankish principality of Antioch and the Turkish states of Asia Minor alike, thus regaining for the empire a decisive role in Syrian affairs. This resurgence of Byzantine military power, the last in its history, redrew the map of conflict between the Arabs and the Frange. The permanent threat to his borders now represented by the Rum prevented Nur al-Din from launching the sweeping reconquest he had desired. But since the power of the son of Zangi also kept in check any expansionist inclinations on the part of the Frange, the situation in Syria was effectively at an impasse. Then, suddenly, as if the pent-up energies of the Arabs and the Frange were seeking some other outlet, the epicenter of war shifted to a new theater of operations, Egypt. Chapter 9. The Rush for the Nile. My uncle Shirku turned to me and said, "Yusuf, pack your things. We're going." When I heard this order, I felt as if my heart had been pierced by a dagger, and I answered, "In God's name, even were I granted the entire kingdom of Egypt, I would not go." The man who spoke those words was none other than Saladin, recounting the timid beginnings of the adventure that would someday make him one of history's most prestigious sovereigns. With the admirable sincerity typical of everything he said, Saladin carefully refrained from claiming credit for the Egyptian epic. "In the end, I did go with my uncle," he added. "He conquered Egypt, then died. God then placed in my hands power that I had never expected." In fact, although Saladin emerged as the great beneficiary of the Egyptian expedition, it is true that he did not play the major role in it. Nor did Nur al-Din, even though the land of the Nile was conquered in his name. The real protagonists of this campaign, which lasted from 1163 to 1169, were three extraordinary personalities: Shawar, an Egyptian vizier whose demoniacal intrigues plunged the region into blood and iron; Amalric, a Frankish king so obsessed with the idea of conquering Egypt that he invaded the country 5 times in 6 years; and Shirku, the lion, a Kurdish general, who proved to be one of the military geniuses of his time. When Shawar seized power in Cairo in December 1162, he assumed a post and responsibility that rewarded its holder with honors and riches. But he was not unaware of the other side of the coin. Of the 15 previous leaders of Egypt, only one had left office alive. All the others had been killed, although the methods varied. They had been hanged, beheaded, stabbed to death, crucified, poisoned, lynched by mobs. One was killed by his adoptive son, another by his own father. In other words, there is no reason to suppose that this dark-skinned emir with the graying temples would allow his freedom of action to be restricted by any hint of scruples. The moment he acceded to power, he quickly massacred his predecessor, along with his entire family, and appropriated their gold, jewels, and palace. But the wheel of fortune continued to spin. After 9 months in power, the new vizier was himself overthrown by one of his lieutenants, a man named Dirham. Having been warned in time, Shawar managed to get out of Egypt alive, and he sought refuge in Syria, where he tried to win Nur al-Din's support for his effort to regain power. Although his guest was intelligent and an effective speaker, at first the son of Zangyi lent him but half an ear. Very soon, however, events were to force Nur al-Din to change his attitude. Jerusalem, it seems, was closely watching the upheavals in Cairo. In February 1162, the Frange had acquired a new king, a man of indomitable ambition. The Arabs called him Mori, from the French Amari, Amalric. He was the second son of Fulk. Visibly influenced by the propaganda of Nur al-Din, this 26-year-old monarch was trying to cultivate the image of a sober, pious man, devoted to religious study and concerned about justice. But the resemblance was only apparent. The Frankish king had more audacity than wisdom, and despite his great height and impressive head of hair, he was singularly lacking in majesty. His shoulders were abnormally thin. He was frequently seized by fits of laughter so long and noisy that his own entourage was embarrassed by them. He was also afflicted with a stutter that did not facilitate his contact with others. Amalric was driven by one obsession, the conquest of Egypt, and only his indefatigable pursuit of that dream afforded him a certain stature. His goal, true enough, seemed tempting. The route to the Nile had been open to the Western Knights ever since 1153, when they took Ascalon, the last Fatimid bastion, in Palestine. Moreover, since 1160, the successive Egyptian viziers, absorbed in their fights with local rivals, had been paying an annual tribute to the Frange in exchange for their abstaining from any intervention in Egyptian affairs. Just after the fall of Shawar, Amalric took advantage of the confusion that prevailed in the land of the Nile to invade, on the simple pretext that the necessary sum, 60,000 dinars, had not been paid on time. Crossing the Sinai Peninsula along its Mediterranean coast, Amalric laid siege to the town of Bilbaiz, situated on a branch of the Nile that would run dry in centuries to come. The defenders of the city were both dumbfounded and amused when the Frange began erecting siege machinery around the walls, for it was September, and the river was beginning to swell. The authorities had only to breach a few dikes, and the warriors of the Occident soon found themselves surrounded by water. They barely had time to flee back to Palestine. The first invasion was thus over in short order, but at least it had awakened Aleppo and Damascus to Amalric's intentions. Nur al-Din hesitated. He had no wish to be drawn into the treacherous swamps of Cairene intrigues, in particular since, as a fervent Sunni, he was openly contemptuous of the Sheikhic caliphate of the Fatimids. On the other hand, he had no wish to see Egypt, with its great riches, swept into the camp of the Frange, for that would make them the greatest power in the Orient. In view of the prevailing anarchy, however, it was unlikely that Cairo would withstand Amalric's determination for long. Shawar, of course, spared no effort in lecturing his host about the potential benefits of an expedition to the land of the Nile. To placate him, Shawar promised that if Nur al-Din helped him to regain his throne, he would pay all the expenses of the expedition, recognize the suzerainty of the master of Aleppo and Damascus, and hand over one-third of state receipts every year. Above all, Nur al-Din had to reckon with his confidant Shirkou, who had been completely won over to the idea of an armed intervention. In fact, he was so enthusiastic about it that the son of Zangyi finally authorized him to take personal charge of organizing an expeditionary corps. It would be difficult to imagine two people so closely united and yet so different as Nur al-Din and Shirkou. With age, the son of Zangi had become increasingly majestic, sober, dignified, and reserved, while Saladin's uncle was a short, obese, one-eyed officer who was constantly flushed by excesses of food and drink. When he lost his temper, he would howl like a madman, and from time to time he would lose his head completely, going so far as to kill his opponent. But not everyone was displeased by his unsavory character. His soldiers adored this commander who lived among them, sharing their mess and their jokes. In the many battles in which he had taken part in Syria, Shirkuh had emerged as a genuine leader of men, gifted with great physical courage. The Egyptian campaign, however, would reveal his remarkable qualities as a strategist, for from the outset the odds were dead against the enterprise. It was relatively easy for the Frange to get to the land of the Nile. The only obstacle impeding their path was the semi-desert expanse of the Sinai Peninsula. But if they took along several hundred water-filled goatskins carried by camels, the knights would have enough water to reach the gates of Bilbaiz in 3 days. Things were less easy for Shirkuh. To travel from Syria to Egypt, he had to cross Palestine and thus expose himself to attacks by the Frange. The departure for Cairo of the Syrian Expeditionary Corps in April 1164 therefore required elaborate staging. While Nur al-Din's army launched a diversionary attack to lure Amalric and his knights to northern Palestine, Shirkuh, accompanied by Shawar and about 10,000 cavalry, headed east. They followed the course of the Jordan River on its east bank, passing through what is now Jordan, and then at the southern tip of the Dead Sea, they turned west, forded the river, and set out at full gallop toward Sinai. There they continued their advance, keeping away from the coastal route so as to avoid detection. On the 24th of April, they seized Bilbaiz, Egypt's easternmost port, and by the 1st of May, they were camped at the walls of Cairo. Taken unawares, the vizier Dirham had no time to organize any resistance. Abandoned by everyone, he was killed trying to escape, and his body was thrown to the dogs in the street. Shawar was officially reinvested in his post by the Fatimid Caliph al-Hadid, a 13-year-old adolescent. Shirkuh's blitz was a model of military efficiency. Saladin's uncle was more than a little proud at having conquered Egypt in so short a time, practically without suffering any losses, and of thus having outwitted Mori. But barely had he reassumed power when Shawar did an astonishing volte-face. Breaking his promises to Nur al-Din, he ordered Shirkuh to leave Egypt forthwith. Saladin's uncle, flabbergasted by such ingratitude and raging with anger, sent word to his former ally that he was determined to stay, regardless. Shawar had no real confidence in his own army, and when he saw Shirkuh's determination, he dispatched an ambassador to Jerusalem to seek Amalric's aid against the Syrian Expeditionary Corps. The Frankish king needed no convincing. He had been looking for an excuse to intervene in Egypt, and what a better pretext could he ask than a call for help from the ruler of Cairo himself? In July 1164, the Frankish army set out for Sinai for the second time. Shirkuh immediately decided to withdraw from the environs of Cairo, where he had been camped since May, and to dig in at Bilbaiz. There he repulsed the attacks of his enemies week after week, but his position seemed ultimately hopeless. Far removed from his bases and surrounded by the Frange and their new ally Shawar, the Kurdish general could not expect to hold out for long. When Nur al-Din saw how the situation in Bilbaiz was developing, Ibn al-Athir wrote several years later, he decided to launch a great offensive against the Frange in an effort to force them to leave Egypt. He wrote to all the Muslim emirs asking them to participate in the jihad, and he marched off to attack the powerful fortress of Harim, near Antioch. All the Frange who had remained in Syria united to confront him. Among them were Prince Baldwin, Lord of Antioch, and the Count of Tripoli. The Frange were crushed in this battle. 10,000 of them were killed, and all their commanders, among them the Prince and the Count, were captured. Once victory was won, Nur al-Din had the cross, embossed banners, and blonde scalps of some of the Frange killed in the battle brought to him. Then, placing them all in a sack, he entrusted the bundle to one of his most reliable men, telling him, "Go immediately to Bilbaiz, find a way to get inside, and give these trophies to Shirkuh. Tell him that God has granted us victory. Let him exhibit them on the ramparts, and the sight will strike fear among the infidels. News of the Harim victory did indeed change things in the battle for Egypt. The morale of the besieged soared, but more important, the Franges were forced to return to Palestine. The capture of young Baldwin III, Reynald's successor at the head of the Principality of Antioch, whom Amalric had appointed to oversee the affairs of the Kingdom of Jerusalem during his absence, and the massacre of his men, forced the king to seek a compromise with Shirkuh. After several exchanges, the two men agreed to leave Egypt simultaneously. At the end of October 1164, Murray returned to Palestine by the coastal route, while the Kurdish general took less than 2 weeks to get back to Damascus, following the same itinerary as before. Shirkuh was far from unhappy at having left Bilbaiz unharmed and with his head held high, but the real winner of the 6 months of campaigning was undoubtedly Shawar. He had used Shirkuh to regain power and then used Amalric to neutralize the Kurdish general. Then both had departed, leaving him master of all Egypt. Shawar would now spend more than 2 years consolidating his position. But not without some uneasiness at the turn events had taken. He knew that Shirkuh would never forgive his betrayal. Indeed, news constantly reached him from Syria, suggesting that the Kurdish general was harassing Nur al-Din, asking his permission to undertake a fresh Egyptian campaign. The son of Zangi, however, was reluctant. He was not dissatisfied with the status quo. The important thing was to keep the Franges away from the Nile. As always, though, it was not easy to disengage from the web. Fearing another lightning expedition by Shirkuh, Shawar took the precaution of concluding a treaty of mutual assistance with Amalric. This convinced Nur al-Din to authorize his lieutenant to organize a fresh expeditionary corps, just in case the Franges moved to intervene in Egypt. Shirkuh selected the best elements of the army, among them his nephew Yusuf. These preparations in turn alarmed the Egyptian vizier, who insisted that Amalric send troops. Thus it was that during the early days of 1167, the race for the Nile began again. The Frankish king and the Kurdish general arrived in the coveted country at about the same time, each by his usual route. Shawar and the Franges assembled their allied forces before Cairo, there to await Shirkuh. But the latter preferred to determine the modalities of the rendezvous himself. Continuing his long march from Aleppo, he skirted the Egyptian capital to the south, sent his troops across the Nile on small boats, and then turned them north again, without even stopping to rest. Shawar and Amalric, who expected Shirkuh to arrive from the east, suddenly saw him surge up from the opposite direction. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.